paralleled by a painted black line. Just outside of the engraved line, the wall had been scraped to show the light ivory-tan natural color of the stone. It highlighted the outline and the colors with which the mammoth had been painted, and contributed to the three-dimensional quality of the work. But it was the paint within the outline that was so remarkable. Through observation and training from those who first conceived of the idea of taking a living animal and reproducing it on a two-dimensional surface, the artists who had painted the walls of the cave had gained a surprising and innovative knowledge of perspective. The techniques had been passed down, and though some artists were more skilled than others, most of them used shading to convey the sense of lifelike fullness. As Ayla moved past the mammoth, she had the eerie sensation that the mammoth had also moved. She felt impelled to reach for the painted animal and touch the stone, then closed her eyes. It was cold, slightly damp, with the texture and feel of any limestone cave. But when she opened her eyes, she noticed that the artist had used the stone wall itself to advantage in the incredibly realistic creation. The mammoth had been placed on the wall in such a way that a rounded shape of the stone became fullness of the belly, and a concretion of stalactite adhering to the wall that suggested a leg was painted as the back of a leg. In the flickering light of the oil lamps, she noticed that when she moved, she saw the animal from a slightly different angle, which changed the way the natural relief of the stone appeared and threw shadows to a slightly different position. Even standing still, watching the reflections of the fire move on the stone, she had the impression that the animal painted on the wall was breathing. She understood then the reason that the mammoth had seemed to shift when she moved, and knew that if she hadn't examined it carefully, she could easily be convinced that it had. She was reminded of the time at the clan gathering when she had to prepare the special drink Issa taught her to make for the Mogurs. The Mogur had shown her how to stand in the shadows so she would not be noticed, and told her exactly when to move out of them, which made it seem that she suddenly appeared. There was method to the magic of those who dealt with the world of the spirits, but there was magic, too. She had felt something when she touched the wall, something that she couldn't quite explain or understand. It was a hint of that certain strangeness she had occasionally felt ever since she had inadvertently swallowed the leavings of the Mogur's drink and followed them into the cave. From that time on, she occasionally experienced disturbing dreams and sometimes unsettling sensations, even when she was awake. She shook her head to rid herself of the feeling, then looked up and saw that the others were watching her. Smiling diffidently, she pulled her hand away from the stone wall quickly, afraid she had done something wrong, then looked toward the woman who held the torch. The acolyte said nothing as she turned to lead the way along the passage. The lights from the small flames glinted faintly off damp walls, with eerie hints of reflections as they moved quietly in single file along the corridor. There was a tingle of apprehension in the air. Ayla was sure they were going into the very heart of the steep limestone cliff, and was glad to be with other people, sure she would get lost if she were alone. She trembled with a sudden flash of fear and foreboding, and a sense of what it might be like to be in a cave alone. She tried to shake off the feeling, but the chill in the dark, cool cave was not easy to dispel. Not far beyond the first one, there was another mammoth, then more mammoths, then two small horses, painted primarily in black. She stopped to look at them more closely. Again, a line perfectly defining the shape of a horse was engraved in the limestone, highlighted by a line painted in black. Within the line, the horses were painted black. But as with the rest of the paintings, the shading gave them a surprising realism. Ayla noticed then that there were paintings on the right wall of the passage as well, some facing out and some in. Mammoths predominated. It seemed that a herd of mammoths was painted on the walls. Using the counting words, Ayla counted at least 10 on both sides of the passage. There may have been more. As she was continuing down the dark corridor, looking at the paintings momentarily lighted as she passed by, She was brought to a halt by the arresting scene of two reindeer greeting each other on the left wall. She had to see them better. The first reindeer facing into the cave was male. He was painted in black, with the definitive shape and contours of the animal accurately rendered, including his huge antlers, though they were suggested by the arcing shapes rather than precisely painted with all their points. His head was lowered, and to Ayla's wonder and surprise, he was tenderly licking the forehead of a female. Unlike the majority of deer, female reindeer also had antlers, and in the painting, as in life, hers were smaller. She was painted in red, and her knees were bent so she could lower herself to accept his gentle caress. The scene manifested a genuine sense of tenderness and caring, and it made Ayla think of Jandalar and herself. She had never thought of animals being in love before, but these seemed to be. It nearly brought her to tears, she was so moved. The acolyte guides allowed her to spend some time. They understood her reaction. They, too, were moved by this exquisite scene. Jandalar was also staring in wonder at the painted reindeer. "That's a new one," he said. "I thought there was a mammoth there." "There was. If you look closely at the female, you can still see some of the mammoth underneath," the young man in the rear explained. "Jonakal made that," the woman in front said. Both Jandalar and Ayla looked at the artist acolyte with new respect.
"Now I understand why you are Zelandani's acolyte," Jandalar said. "You are extraordinarily gifted."
Jonakal nodded to acknowledge Jandalar's comment.
"We all have our gifts. I'm told you are an extraordinarily gifted flintknapper. I look forward to seeing some of your work. In fact, there's a tool I've been trying to get someone to make for me, but I can't quite seem to explain it to any of the toolmakers so they understand. I was hoping Dalinar would be coming to the summer meeting so I could ask him."
"He is planning to come, but I'll be glad to give your idea a try if you like," Jandalar said. "I enjoy a challenge."
"Perhaps we can talk tomorrow," Jonakal said.
"Can I ask you something, Jonakal?" Ayla said.
"Of course."
"Why did you paint the deer on top of the mammoth?"
"That wall, that place, drew me to it," Jonakal said. "It's where I had to put the reindeer. They were in the wall and wanted to come out."
"It is a special wall. It leads beyond," the woman said. "When the first sings there or a flute is played, that wall answers. It echoes, resonates to the sound. Sometimes it tells you what it wants." "Did all these walls tell someone to make paintings on them?" Ayla asked, indicating the paintings they had passed by. "That's one reason this deep is so sacred. Most of the walls talk to you if you know how to listen. They lead you places if you're willing to go."
"No one ever told me this before, not in exactly this way. Why are you telling us now?"
Jandalar asked. "Because you will have to listen and perhaps go through if you're going to help the first find the elan of your brother Jandalar," the woman said. Then she added, "The Zelandanya have been trying to understand why Jonakal was inspired to make these figures here. I'm beginning to get an idea." The woman smiled enigmatically at Jandalar and Ayla, then turned to walk deeper into the cave. "Oh, before you go on," Ayla said to the woman, touching her arm to detain her, "I don't know what to call you. Can I ask your name?"
"My name isn't important," she said. "When I become Zelandani, I will be giving it up anyway. I am the first acolyte to the Zelandani of the second cave."
"Then I suppose I could call you acolyte of the second," Ayla said.
"Yes, you could. Although the Zelandani of the second has more than one acolyte, the other two are not here. They've gone ahead to the summer meeting."
"Then perhaps first acolyte of the second?"
"If it pleases you, I will respond to that name."
"What should I call you?" Ayla asked the young man who brought up the rear.
"I've only been an acolyte since the last summer meeting, and like Jonakal, I still use my own name most of the time. Perhaps I should give you a formal greeting and introduction."
He held out both his hands.
I am Michaelan of the 14th Cave of the Zelandanyi, second acolyte of the Zelandani of the 14th Cave, and I welcome you, he said. Ayla took his hands in hers. I greet you, Michaelan of the 14th Cave of the Zelandanyi. I am Ayla of the Mamutoi, member of the Lion Camp, daughter of the Mammoth Hearth, chosen by the spirit of the Cave Lion, protected by the Cave Bear, friend of the horses, Winnie and Racer, and the hunter, Wolf. I seem to have heard that some people to the east refer to their Zelandanya as the Mammoth Hearth, the woman acolyte said.
You're correct, Jondalar said. They are the Mamutoi. Ayla and I lived with them for a year, but I'm surprised anyone here has heard about them. They live far away.
She looked at Ayla. If you are a daughter of the Mammoth Hearth, that explains some things. You are Zelandani. No, I am not, Ayla said. The Mammut adopted me to the Mammoth Hearth. I wasn't called, but he was starting to teach me some things before I left with Jondalar.
The woman smiled.
You would not have been adopted if you were not meant to be. I am sure you will be called. I don't think I want to be, Ayla said.
That may be, the first acolyte of the second said, then turned and continued leading them into the heart of Fountain Rocks. Ahead, they began to see a glow, and as they approached, it grew almost brilliant.
After the total darkness of the cave, with only a few small lights, their eyes had adapted, and any greater illumination was all but dazzling. The corridor opened out, and Ayla saw several people waiting in an enlarged area. It seemed almost crowded, and as she reached the area and recognized people she had met, she realized that everyone there was Zelandanya, except for Jondalar and her. The large woman from the ninth cave was sitting on a seat someone had brought in for her. She got up and smiled.
"We've been waiting for you," said the first.
She gave both of them a hug that was held at a slight distance, and Ayla suddenly understood that it was a formal embrace, a greeting one gave to close associates in public. One of the other Zelandanya nodded to Ayla. She responded with a nod to the short and slightly built man she identified as Zelandani of the 11th, the one who had impressed her with his strong grip and self-confidence. An older man smiled at her, and she smiled back at Zelandani of the 3rd, who had been so kind and supportive when she was trying to help Chevenar. She recognized most of the others only as people she had met and greeted. A small fire had been made on top of some stones that had been brought in for the purpose. They would be taken back out when they left. A partially filled water bag was on the ground beside a good-sized wooden cooking bowl full of steaming water. Ayla watched a young woman use a pair of bent wood tongs to fish out a couple of cooking stones from the bottom of the cooking bowl, then add more from the fire. The steam billowed out as the hot rocks touched the water. When she looked up, Ayla recognized Majera and smiled at her. Then the one who was first added some material from a pouch. She's making a decoction, cooking it, not just steeping a tea, Ayla thought. There is probably some root or bark in that drink, something strong. The next time hot stones were added, the billowing steam filled the air with a strong aroma. The mint was easy to detect, but she smelled other odors and flavors which she tried to identify and suspected that the mint was there to cover the taste of something less pleasant. A couple of people spread a heavy leather covering on the damp and rocky floor near the seat that the first had occupied.
Ayla, Jondalar, why don't you come over here and make yourselves comfortable?
The large woman said, indicating the leather.
I have something for you to drink.
The young woman who was tending the potion in the cooking bowl brought out 4 cups in preparation.
It's not quite ready yet, but you might as well relax.
Ayla has been enjoying the wall paintings, Jonakal said. I think she might like to see more of them. It might be more relaxing than sitting there waiting until that drink is ready.
Yes, I would like to see more, Ayla added quickly. She found herself suddenly feeling rather anxious about drinking some unknown decoction that she knew was intended to help her find some other world.
Her past experience with similar drinks had not been especially agreeable. Zelandani observed her closely for a while. She knew Jonikol well enough to understand that he would not have made the suggestion without good reason. He must have noted that the young woman was showing some distress, and she did seem to be agitated.
"Certainly, Jonikol. Why don't you show her the painted walls?"
the first said.
"I'd like to go with them,"
Jondalar said. He wasn't feeling very calm himself.
"And maybe the torch carrier could come with us."
"Yes, of course," said the first acolyte of the second, picking up the torch she had put out. "I'll need to relight it."
"There is some fine work on the wall behind the Zelandanya, but I don't want to bother them,"
Jonikol said.
"Let me show you something interesting down this corridor."
He led them down a passageway that turned off to the right from the main one. Immediately on the left, he stopped in front of another panel of reindeer and a horse.
"Did you do these, too?" Ayla asked.
"No, my teacher did. She used to be Zelandani of the Second, before Kimaran's sister. She was an exceptional painter,"
Jonikol said.
"She was good, but I think the student has outdone the teacher," Jondalar said.
"Well, for the Zelandanya, it is not so much the quality, although it is appreciated. It is the experience. These paintings are not just for looking at, you know," the first acolyte of the second said.
"I'm sure that's true," Jondalar said with a wry smile. "But for me, I think I like the looking more. I must admit I'm not exactly waiting eagerly for this ceremony. I'm willing, of course, and I think it may be interesting, but for the most part I'm happy to let the Zelandanya have the experience."
Jonikol grinned at his admission. "You are not alone in that feeling, Jondalar. Most people would rather stay firmly in this world. Come, let me show you something else before we have to get serious." The artist acolyte led them to another area on the right side of the passage where many more stalagmites and stalactites than usual had formed. The wall was covered with the calcareous formations, but on top of the concretions had been painted two horses that incorporated them to create the effect of a long, shaggy winter coat. The one behind was leaping in a very animated way.
"These are very lively," Ayla said, quite intrigued. She had seen horses behave in similar ways.
"When boys first see it, they always say this one in back is leaping for pleasure,"
Jondalar said. "That is one interpretation," the woman acolyte said. "That could be a male attempting to mount the female in front, but I believe it is purposely ambiguous."
"Did your teacher paint these, Jonikol?"
Ayla asked.
"No, I don't know who made them," Jonikol said. "No one does. They were done long ago when the mammoths were painted. People say they were made by the ancestors, the forebears."
"There is something I want to show you, Ayla," the woman said.
"Are you going to show her the vulva?"
Jonikol said with some surprise. "That is not usually shown on a first visit."
"I know, but I think we should make an exception for her," the other acolyte said, holding up the lamp and leading the way to a place not far from the horses.
When she stopped, she lowered the torch to throw light down on a very unusual formation of rock that extended out from the wall and parallel to the floor, but raised up from it. When Ayla first looked, she noticed an area of stone that had been enhanced with red, but it was only after looking carefully that she understood what it was, and then perhaps only because she had assisted more than one woman who was giving birth. A man might have recognized it before a woman. By accident or supernatural design, the concretion had naturally formed an exact replica of a woman's sexual organ. The shape, the folds, even a depression that matched the entrance to her vagina, everything was there. Only the red color was added to highlight it, to make sure they could find it easily.
"It is a woman,"
Ayla said, astonished.
"It is exactly like a woman. I have never seen anything like it."
"Now do you understand why this cave is so sacred? The mother herself made this for us. It is proof that this cave is the entrance to the mother's womb," said the woman who was training to serve the Great Earth Mother.
"Have you seen this before, Jondalar?" Ayla asked.
Only once. Zelandani showed it to me, he said. It is remarkable. It is one thing for an artist like Jonacol to look at a cave wall, see the figure that is in it, and bring it to the surface for everyone to see. But this was here, just as it is. The added color only makes it a little easier to see.
There is one more place I want to show you, Jonacol said. He went back the way they had come, and when they reached the enlarged area where everyone was waiting, he hurried past and turned right, back into the main corridor. At what appeared to be the end, on the left, was a circular enclosure, and on the wall were concave depressions, the reverse of rounded-out bumps. In some of these, mammoths had been painted in a way that created an unusual illusion. At first glance, they didn't appear to be depressions. Instead, they took on the characteristic of a mammoth's stomach, rounded outward. Ayla had to look twice, then reach to touch to convince herself that they were actually concave, not convex, dips, and not bumps.
They are remarkable, Ayla said. They are painted so that they seem to be opposite of what they are.
These are new, aren't they? I don't recall seeing them before,
Jondalar said.
Did you paint them, Jonacol?
No, but I'm sure you'll meet the woman who did, he said.
Everyone agrees. She is exceptional, the woman acolyte said. As is Jonacol, of course. We are lucky to have two artists who are so talented.
A few small figures are just beyond here, Jonacol said, looking at Ayla. A woolly rhinoceros, a cave lion, an engraved horse, but it's a very narrow passage and hard to reach. A series of lines marks the end.
They're probably ready for us. I think we should go back, the woman said.
As they turned around and were heading back, Ayla glanced up on the right wall, opposite the chapel-like enclosure with the mammoths, and back along the corridor a short way. A strange feeling of uneasiness came over her. She was afraid she knew what was coming. She had felt it before. The first time was when she made the drink from the special roots for the Mogurs. Issa had told her it was too sacred to be wasted, so she wasn't allowed to practice making it. She had already become disoriented, first from chewing the roots to soften them, then from the other preparations she had drunk during that night of special ceremony and celebration. When she noticed that there was some liquid left in the ancient bowl, she drank it, so it wouldn't be wasted. The potent concoction had become stronger from soaking, and the effect on her was devastating. In her confused state, she had followed the light of the fires into the honeycombed depths of the cave, and when she'd come upon Kreb and the other Mogurs, she hadn't been able to go back. Kreb was changed after that night, and she was never the same either. That was when the mysterious dream started, and the waking moments of strange feelings and enigmatic visions that took her to some other place and sometimes came as warnings. They had been stronger and more prevalent on their journey. And now, as she stared up at the wall, the solid stone suddenly felt tenuous, as though she could see through it or into it. Instead of the firelights barely glinting off the hard surface, the wall was soft and deep and utterly black, and she was there inside that menacing nebulous space and couldn't find her way out. She felt exhausted and weak, and she hurt deep inside. Then suddenly Wolf appeared. He was running through the tall grass, racing to meet her, coming to find her.
"Ayla, Ayla, are you all right?"
Jondalar said.
Chapter 18.
Ayla,
Jondalar said louder.
What? Oh, Jondalar, I saw a wolf, she said, blinking her eyes and shaking her head to try to overcome her dazed confusion and vague sense of foreboding.
What do you mean you saw wolf? He didn't come with us, remember? You left him with Valara,
Jondalar said, his forehead creased with fear and concern.
I know, but he was there, she said, pointing to the wall. He came for me when I needed him.
He has before, Jondalar said. He saved your life more than once. Maybe you were remembering.
Maybe,
Ayla said, but she didn't really think that was it.
Did you say you saw a wolf there on that wall? Jonacol said.
Not exactly on it, Ayla said, but Wolf was there.
I do think we need to go back, the woman acolyte said, but she was staring at her with a speculative expression.
There you are, Zelandani of the Ninth said when they returned to the widened area of the corridor. Are you feeling more relaxed now and ready to proceed?
She was smiling, but Ayla had the distinct impression that the large woman was impatient and not entirely pleased. After her vivid memory of the time when she drank some liquid that altered her perceptions and her moment of displacement when she saw Wolf in the wall, Ayla was, if anything, feeling less inclined to drink some kind of beverage that would put her into some other kind of reality or next world. But she didn't feel that she had a choice.
It's not easy to feel relaxed in a cave like this, Ayla said, and it frightens me to think about drinking that tea. But if you think it is necessary, I'm willing to do what you want.
The first smiled again, and this time it seemed genuine.
Your honesty is refreshing, Ayla. Of course it's not easy to relax here. That's not the purpose of this place. And you're probably right to have some fear of this tea. It is very powerful. I was going to explain to you that you will feel strange after you drink it, and its effects are not entirely predictable. The effects usually wear off in a day or so, and I don't know of anyone who's been harmed by it. But if you'd rather not, no one will hold it against you.
Ayla frowned in thought, wondering if she should refuse, but though she was glad she had been given the choice, it made it harder to say no.
If you want me to, I am willing, she said.
I'm sure your participation would be helpful, Ayla, said the Danya. Yours as well, Jondalar, but I hope you understand. You also have the right to refuse.
You know I've always been uncomfortable with the spirit world, Zelandani, Jondalar said. And in the last couple of days, what with digging graves and everything, I've been much closer to that place than I want to be until the mother calls me. But I was the one who asked you to help Thonalin, and I can do no less than help you in any way I can. In fact, I'll be just as glad to get it all over with.
Then why don't you both come over here and sit down on this leather pad, and we'll proceed, said the first among those who served the great Earth Mother.
When they sat down, the young woman ladled the tea into cups. Ayla glanced at Majera and smiled. She smiled back, shyly, and Ayla realized that she was quite young. She seemed nervous, and Ayla wondered if it was the first time for her to be participating in this kind of ceremony. Probably the Zelandania were using this occasion as a teaching experience.
Take your time,
they were told by Zelandani of the Third, who was assisting the acolyte in handing them the cups.
It tastes strong, but with the mint it's not too bad.
Ayla took a sip and thought not too bad was a matter of opinion. Under any other circumstances she would have spit it out. The fire in the hearth was out, but the beverage was rather hot, and she thought that whatever else was in it actually made the mint taste bad. Besides, this wasn't really a tea. It had been boiled, not steeped, and boiling never did bring out the best qualities of mint. She wondered if there weren't other, more compatible, innocuous, or healing herbs that might blend with the primary ingredients in a pleasanter way. Licorice root, perhaps, or linden flowers added later, after it was boiled. In any case, it wasn't a taste to savor, and she finally just drank it down. She saw that Jondalar had done the same, and so did the first. Then she noticed that Majera, who had boiled the water and ladled the beverage, had also drunk a cup.
Jondalar, is this the stone you brought with you from Thonalin's burial?
The first said, showing him the small, sharp-edged, ordinary-looking gray stone with one iridescent blue opal face.
Yes, it is, he said.
He would recognize that stone anywhere.
Good. It is an unusual stone, and I'm sure it still carries a trace of your brother's elan. Take it in your hand, Jondalar, and then hold hands with Ayla, so that the stone is held by both of you. Move close to my seat, and with your other hand, take my hand. Now, Majera, you move up close to me and take my hand, and Ayla, if you will come a little closer, you and Majera can hold hands. Majera must be a new acolyte, Ayla thought. I wonder if it is her first time for something like this. It's my first time with the Zelandanyi, although that time at the clan gathering with Kreb was probably similar, and of course what I did with Mahmut was. She found herself recalling her last experience with the old man of the lion camp who interceded with the spirit world, and it did not make her feel better. When Mahmut found out she'd had some of the special clan roots that the Mogurs used, he wanted to try them, but he was unfamiliar with their properties, and they were stronger than he had thought. They were both nearly lost to the deep void, and Mahmut warned her against ever using them again. Though she did have more of those roots with her, she didn't plan to take them. The four who had consumed the drink were now facing each other, holding hands. The first sitting on a low padded stool, the rest sitting on the leather mat on the ground. The Zelandani of the 11th brought an oil lamp and placed it in the middle of them. Ayla had seen similar lamps, but found herself quite intrigued by it. She was already beginning to feel some effects from the drink as she stared at the stone that held fire. The lamp was made of limestone. The general shape, including the bowl-like section and the handle extension, had been pecked out with a much harder stone, like granite. Then it was smoothed with sandstone and decorated with symbolic markings etched in with a flint burin. Three wicks were resting against the side of the bowl opposite the handle at different angles, each with one end sticking out of the liquid fat and the rest of the absorbent material soaking in it. One was quick-starting and hot-burning lichen that melted the fat. The second was a dried moss twisted into a sort of cord that gave good light. And the third was made of a dried strip of a porous fungus that absorbed the liquefied fat so well it kept burning even after the oil was gone. The animal fat that was used for the fuel had been rendered in boiling water so that the impurities fell to the bottom, leaving only pure white tallow floating on top after the water cooled. The flame burned clean, with no visible smoke or soot. Ayla glanced around and noted, somewhat to her dismay, that a Zelandani was putting out an oil lamp, and then she saw another going out. Soon all the lamps were out except for the one in the center. Seeming to defy its diminutive size, the light from the single lamp spread out and lit the faces of the four people holding hands with a warm golden glow. But beyond the circle, deep and utter darkness filled every cranny, every crack and hollow, with a black so complete it felt thick and stifling. Ayla began to feel apprehensive. Then she turned her head and caught the bare glimpse of a glow coming from the long corridor. Some of the lamps that had guided their way must still be lit, she thought, and let out a breath that she didn't know she was holding. She was feeling very strange. The decoction was taking effect quickly. It seemed as though things around her were slowing down, or that she was going faster. She looked at Jondalar and found him staring at her, and she had the strangest sense that she almost knew what he was thinking. Then she looked at Zelandani and Majera and felt something, too, but it was not as strong as her feeling with Jondalar, and she wondered if she was imagining it. She became conscious of hearing music, flutes, drums, and people singing, but not with words. She wasn't quite sure when or even from where it originated. Each singer maintained a single note or series of repetitive notes until he or she ran out of breath, and then would take a breath and start again. Most singers and the drummers repeated the same thing over and over, but a few exceptional singers varied their song, as did most of the flute players. Beginning and ending at each person's own choosing meant that no two people started or stopped at the same time. The effect was a continuous sound of interweaving tones that changed as new voices began and others ended, with an overlay of divergent melodies. It was sometimes atonal, sometimes closely harmonic, but overall a strangely wonderful, beautiful, and powerful fugue. The other three people in her circle were singing as well. The first, with her beautiful, rich contralto, was one who varied her tones in a melodic way. Majera had a pure high voice and a simple, repetitive set of tones.
Jondalar also sang a repetition of tones, a chant he had obviously perfected and was happy with. Ayla had never really heard him sing before, but his voice was rich and true, and she liked the sound. She wondered why he didn't sing more. Ayla felt that she should join in, but she had attempted to sing when she lived with a mamutoi and knew she simply didn't know how to carry a tune. She never learned as a child, and it was a little late to learn now. Then she heard one of the men nearby who just crooned in a monotone. It reminded her of when she was living alone in her valley and used to hum a similar monotone at night while she rocked herself to sleep. The leather cloak that she had used to hold her son to her hip crumpled up into a ball and held close to her stomach. Very softly, she began to hum her low-pitched monotone and found herself rocking very slightly. There was something soothing about the music. Her own humming relaxed her, and the sounds of the others gave her a comforting, protected feeling, as though they were supporting her and would be there for her if she needed them. It made it easier for her to give in to the effects of the drink, which was having a strong influence on her. She became acutely aware of the hands she was holding. On her left, the hand of the young woman was cool, moist, and so softly compliant the grip was slack. Ayla clasped Majera's hand, but felt almost no return hold. Even her grasp was young and shy. In contrast, the hand on her right was warm, dry, and slightly calloused from use. Jondalar held her hand with a firm grip as she held his, and she was extremely conscious of the hard stone held between them, which was slightly disconcerting, but his hand made her feel secure. Though she couldn't see it, she was sure the flat opal side was against her palm, which meant that the triangular ridge on the side opposite was in his. As she concentrated on it, the stone seemed to be warming, matching their body heat, adding to it, feeling as though it were becoming a part of them, or they a part of it. She remembered the chill she'd felt when she first entered the cave, and that the cold intensified as they got farther into its depths. But at the moment, sitting on the padded leather and dressed in her warm clothes, she did not feel cold at all. Her attention was caught by the fire in the lamp. It made her think of the pleasant heat of fire in a hearth. She stared at the small flickering flame, became fixated on the bit of incandescence to the exclusion of everything else. She watched the small yellow light as it fluttered and trembled. With every breath she took, she seemed to control the flame. As she watched closely, she saw that the light wasn't entirely yellow. To keep it still while she studied it, she held her breath. The small fire was rounded in the middle, with the brightest yellow part starting near the end of the wick and tapering up to a point. Inside the yellow was a darker area that began below the end of the wick and narrowed into a cone as it rose up within the bit of fire. Below the yellow, at the bottom where the flame began, the fire had a hint of blue. She had never looked at the fire of an oil lamp with such intensity before. When she started breathing again, the lambent fire seemed to be playing with the lamp, moving to the meter of the music. As it danced over the glossy surface of the melted tallow, its light reflecting from the fuel, the flame grew more radiant. It filled her eyes with its softly glowing luminescence until she could see nothing else. It made her feel airy, weightless, carefree, as though she could have floated up into the warmth of the light. Everything was easy, effortless. She smiled, laughed softly, then found herself looking at Jondalar. She thought about the life that he had started growing inside her, and a sudden flood of intense love for him welled up and overflowed. He could not help but respond to her glowing smile. As she watched him begin to smile back, she felt happy, loved. Life was full of joy, and she wanted to share it. She beamed at Majera and was rewarded with a tentative smile in return, then turned to Zelandani and included her in the beneficence of her happiness. In a dispassionate corner of her mind that seemed to have distanced itself from her, she seemed to be watching everything with a strange clarity. "I am getting ready to call Chevenar's Elan and direct him to the spirit world," the one who was first interrupted her singing to say.
Her voice sounded far away, even to her own ears. After we help him, I will try to find the Elan of Fanalan. Jondalar and Ayla will have to help me. Think about how he died and where his bones are resting. To Ayla, the sound of her words was full of music that grew louder and more complex. She heard tones resonating from the walls all around her and watched as the huge Danyar seemed to become a part of the reverberating chant she sang again, a part of the cave itself. She saw the woman's eyes close. When she opened them, she seemed to be seeing something that was far away. Then her eyes rolled back, showing only whites, and closed again as she slumped forward in her seat. The young woman whose hand she was holding was shaking. Ayla wondered if it was from fear or if Majera was simply overwhelmed. She turned to look at Jondalar again. He seemed to be looking at her, and she started to smile, but then she realized that he, too, was staring into space, not seeing her at all, but something far away inside his mind. Suddenly, she found herself back in the vicinity of her valley again. Ayla heard something that chilled her blood and set her heart racing, the thundering roar of a cave lion and a human scream. Jondalar was there with her, inside her, it seemed. She felt the pain of a leg being mauled by the lion. Then he lost consciousness. Ayla stopped, her blood pounding in her ears. It had been so long since she had heard a human sound, yet she knew it was human, and something else. She knew it was her kind of human. She was so stunned that she couldn't think. The scream pulled at her. It was a cry for help. With Jondalar's presence, unconscious, no longer dominant, she could feel the others there. Zelandani, distant but powerful. Majera, closer but vague. Underlying everything was the music, voices and flutes, faint but supporting, comforting, and the drums, deep and resounding. She heard the growling of the cave lion and saw its reddish mane. Then she realized Winnie had not been nervous, and she knew why.
"That's Baby! Winnie, that's Baby!"
There were two men. She pushed aside the lion she had raised and knelt to examine them. Her main concern was as a medicine woman, but she was astonished and curious as well. She knew they were men, though they were the first men of the others she could remember seeing. She knew immediately that the man with the darker hair was beyond hope. He lay in an unnatural position, his neck broken. The tooth marks on his throat proclaimed the cause. Though she had never seen him before, his death upset her. Tears of grief filled her eyes. It wasn't that she loved him, but that she felt she had lost something beyond value before she ever had a chance to appreciate it. She was devastated that the first time she saw people of her own kind, one was dead. She wanted to acknowledge his humanity, to honor him with a burial, but a close look at the other man made her realize that it would be impossible. The man with the yellow hair still breathed, but his life was pumping out of him through a gash in his leg. His only hope was to get him back to the cave as quickly as possible so she could treat him. There was no time for a burial. She didn't know what to do. She didn't want to leave the man there for the lions. She noticed that the loose rock at the back of the blind canyon looked very unstable. Much of it had piled up behind a large boulder that was none too stable itself. She dragged the dead man to the back of the blind canyon near the slide of loose rock. When she finally got the other man wrapped into the travois, she returned to the stone ledge with a long, sturdy clan spear. She looked down at the dead man and felt sorrow for the fact of his death. With the formal, silent motions of the clan, she addressed the world of the spirits. She had watched Kreb, the old Mogur, consign the spirit of Issa to the next world with his eloquent, flowing movements. She had repeated the same gestures when she found Kreb's body in the cave after the earthquake, though she had never known the full meaning of the holy gestures. That wasn't important. She knew the intent. Using the sturdy spear as a lever, in much the same way as she would have used a digging stick to turn over a log or extract a root, she prized free the large stone and jumped back out of the way as a cascade of loose rock covered the dead man. When they neared an opening between jagged rock walls, Ayla dismounted and examined the ground. It held no fresh spore. There was no pain now. It was a different time, much later. The leg was healed. A large scar was all that remained of the wound. They had been riding double on Winnie. Jondalar got down and followed her, but she knew he didn't really want to be there. She led the way into a blind canyon, then climbed up on a rock that had split from the wall. She walked to a rock slide at the back. "This is the place, Jondalar," she said, and withdrawing a pouch from her tunic, gave it to him. He knew this place.
"What is this?"
he asked, holding up the small leather bag.
"Red earth, Jondalar, for his grave."
He nodded, unable to speak. He felt the pressure of tears and made no effort to check them. He poured the red ochre into his hand and broadcast it on the rocks and gravel, then spread a second handful. She waited while he stared at the rocky slope with wet eyes, and when he turned to go, she made a gesture over Thonolin's grave. They arrived at the blind canyon strewn with huge, sharp-angled boulders, and started in, drawn to the slope of loose gravel at the far end. Time had passed again. They were living with the Mamutoi now, and the lion camp was going to adopt her. They had gone back to her valley so Ayla could get some of the things she had made to give as gifts for her new people, and were returning. Jondalar stood at the foot of the slope, wishing there were something he could do to acknowledge this burial place of his brother. Perhaps Dani had already found him, since she called him back to her so young. But he knew Zelindani would try to find this resting place of Thonolin's spirit and help guide him to the spirit world if she could. But how could he tell her where this place was? He couldn't even have found it without Ayla. He noticed Ayla had a small leather pouch in her hand, one similar to the kind she wore around her neck.
"You have told me his spirit should return to Dani," she said. "I don't know the ways of the Great Earth Mother. I only know of the spirit world of the clan totems. I asked my cave lion to guide him there. Maybe it is the same place, or maybe your great mother knows of that place. But the cave lion is a powerful totem, and your brother is not without protection."
She held up the small pouch.
"I made an amulet for you. You, too, were chosen by the cave lion. You don't have to wear it, but you should keep it with you. I put a piece of red ochre in it, so it can hold a piece of your spirit and a piece of your totems. But I think your amulet should hold one more thing."
Jondalar was frowning. He didn't want to offend her, but he wasn't sure if he wanted this clan totem amulet.
"I think you should take a piece of stone from your brother's grave. A piece of his spirit may stay with it, and you can carry it back in your amulet to your people."
The knots of consternation on his forehead deepened, then suddenly cleared. Of course, that might help Zelindani find this place in a spirit trance. Maybe there was more to clan totems than he realized. After all, didn't Dani create the spirits of all the animals?
"Yes, I'll keep this and put a stone from Thonolin's grave into it," he said.
He looked at the loose, sharp-edged gravel sloping against the wall in a tenuous equilibrium. Suddenly a stone, giving way to the cosmic force of gravity, rolled down amid a spattering of other rocks and landed at Jondalar's feet. He picked it up. At first glance, it appeared to be the same as all the other innocuous little pieces of broken granite and sedimentary rock. But when he turned it over, he was surprised to see a shining opalescence where the stone had broken. Fiery red lights gleamed from the heart of the milky white stone, and shimmering streaks of blues and greens danced and sparkled in the sun as he turned it this way and that.
"Ayla, look at this," he said,
showing her the opal facet of the small rock he had picked up.
"You'd never guess it from the back. You'd think it was just an ordinary stone, but look here, where it broke off. The colors seem to come from deep inside, and they're so bright it almost seems alive."
"Maybe it is. Or maybe it is a piece of the spirit of your brother," she said.
Ayla became aware of Jondalar's warm hand and the stone pressing against her palm.
Its heat increased, not enough to cause discomfort, but enough to make her notice it. Was it Thonalan's spirit that was trying to be noticed? She wished she'd had a chance to get to know the man. The things she'd heard about him since she arrived indicated that he had been well-liked. It was a shame that he'd died so young. John Dalar had often said that Thonalan was the one who had wanted to travel. He had gone on the journey only because his brother was going, and because he didn't really want to mate Morona.
"Oh, Donny, great mother, help us to find our way to the other side, to your world, to the place beyond, and yet within the unseen spaces of this world. As the dying old moon holds the new within its slender arms, the world of the spirits, of the unknown, holds this world of the tangible, of flesh and bone, grass and stone, within its unseen grasp. But with your help, it can be seen, it can be known." Ayla heard the plea, sung in the strange, muted chant by the huge woman. She had noticed that she was getting dizzy, though that was not quite the word to describe her sensations. She closed her eyes and felt herself falling. When she opened them again, lights were flashing from within her eyes. Though she had not really paid attention to them when she was looking at the animals, she realized now that she had seen other things, signs and symbols marked on the walls of the cave, some of which matched the visions in her eyes. It didn't seem to matter now whether her eyes were open or closed. She felt that she was falling into a deep hole, a long, dark tunnel, and she resisted the sensation, tried to keep control.
"Don't fight it, Ayla. Let go,"
the great Danyar said.
"We are all here with you. We will support you. Donny will protect you. Let her take you where she will. Listen to the music. Let it help you. Tell us what you see."
Ayla dove through the tunnel head first, as though she were swimming under water. The walls of the tunnel, of the cave, began to shimmer, then seemed to dissolve. She was looking through them, seeing into them, beyond them, to a grassland, and in the distance, many bison.
"I see bison, huge herds of bison on a large open plain," Ayla said.
For a moment, the walls solidified again, but the bison stayed. They covered the walls where the mammoths had been.
"They are on the walls, painted on the walls, painted in reds and black and shaped to fit. They're beautiful, perfect, so full of life, the way Charnacol makes them. Don't you see them? Look, over there."
The walls melted again. She could see into them, through them.
"They're in a field again, a herd of them, heading toward the surround."
Suddenly Ayla screamed.
"No, Chevenar! No! Don't go there! It's dangerous!"
Then, with sorrow and resignation,
"It's too late. I'm sorry. I did everything I could, Chevenar."
She wanted to sacrifice, to show respect, so people know that sometimes they, too, must give of their own, the first said. She was there with Ayla.
"You cannot stay here any more, Chevenar. You must return to her now. I will help you. We will help you. We will show you the way. Come with us, Chevenar."
"Yes, it's dark. But see the light ahead? The bright, glowing light? Go that way. She waits for you there."
Ayla held Jondalar's warm hand. She could feel that the strong presence of Zelindani was with them, and a fourth companion, the young woman with the limp hand, Majera. But she was ambiguous, inconsistent. Occasionally she would manifest quite strongly, then would fade to uncertainty.
"Now is the time. Go to your brother, Jondalar," the large woman said. "Ayla can help you. She knows the way."
Ayla felt the stone they held between them, and thought about the beautiful, blue-toned, milky surface with fiery red highlights. It expanded, filling the space around her until she dove into it. She was swimming, not on top, but through the water, underwater, so fast that it felt as if she were flying.
She was flying, speeding over the landscape, seeing meadows and mountains, forests and rivers, great inland seas and vast grassy steppes, and the profusion of animals those habitats supported.
The others were with her, letting her lead. Jandalar was closest, and she felt him most strongly, but she sensed the proximity of the powerful Danyar as well. The other woman's presence was so faint it was hardly noticed. Aayla took them directly to the blind canyon on the rugged steps far to the east.
"This is the place I saw him. I don't know where to go from here," she said.
"Think of Thonolin. Call to his spirit, Jandalar," Zelandani said. "Reach out to your brother's Elan."
"Thonolin! Thonolin!"
"I can feel him," Jandalar said. "I don't know where he is, but I can feel him."
Aayla had a perception of Jandalar with someone else, though she could not discern who. Then she sensed other presences, at first just a few, then many, calling out to them. Out of the throng, two stood out. No, three. One of them carried an infant.
"Are you still traveling, still exploring, Thonolin?" Jandalar asked.
Aayla heard no answer, but sensed laughter. Then she had the feeling of an infinity of space to travel and places to go.
"Is Jatamio with you and her child?"
Jandalar queried. Again Aayla sensed no words, but felt a surge of love radiating from the amorphous form.
"Thonolin, I know your love of travel and adventure."
This time it was the first who spoke with her thoughts to the Elan of the man. "But the woman with you wants to return to the mother. She has followed you only out of love, but she is ready to go. If you love her, you should go and take her and her infant with you. It is time, Thonolin. The great Earth Mother wants you." Aayla discerned confusion, a sense of being lost.
"I will show you the way," the Danyar said. "Follow me."
Aayla perceived herself being drawn along with the rest, speeding rapidly over a landscape that might have been familiar if the details were not so blurred and if it were not getting so dark. She held tight to the warm hand on her right and felt her left hand being fervently clutched. A brightness appeared before them in the distance that was like a great bonfire, but different. It grew more intense as they approached. They slowed.
"You can find your way from here," Zelandani said.
Aayla sensed relief from the Elans, and then separation. A somber darkness engulfed them, and with the absolute absence of light, a silence, pervasive and complete, surrounded them. Then, faintly in the unearthly quiet, she heard music, a fluctuating fugue of flutes, voices, and drums. She felt movement. They were accelerating at a tremendous rate, but this time it seemed to come from the hand on the left. Majero was clutching hard in fear, determined to return as fast as possible and dragging everyone else along in her wake. When they stopped, Aayla felt both hands holding hers. They were in the immediate presence of the music, back in the cave. Aayla opened her eyes, saw Jandalar, Zelandani, and Majera. The lamp in their midst was sputtering, the oil almost gone and only one wick burning. In the darkness beyond, she saw the small fire of a lamp move, seemingly by itself, and shivered. Another lamp was brought forward and exchanged for the dying light in the center. They were sitting on the leather pad, but now, even in her warm clothing, she felt chilled. They let go of each other's hands, though Aayla and Jandalar held on for a beat or two longer than the rest, and began to shift positions. The one who was first joined in with the singers and brought the musical fugue to a close. More lamps were lit, and people started moving around. Some stood up and stamped their feet.
"I want to ask you something, Aayla,"
the large woman said. Aayla looked at her expectantly.
"Did you say you saw bison on the walls?"
"Yes. The mammoths had been covered over and made into bison, with the shape of the head and the hump on the back filled in, and made to look like the large hump on a bison's withers. And then the walls seemed to disappear, and they became real bison. There were some other animals, the horses and the reindeer facing each other. But I saw this place as a bison cave,"
Aayla said.
"I think your vision is because of the recent bison hunt and the tragedy surrounding it. You were in the midst of it, and you treated Chevenar,"
the first said.
but I think there is a meaning to your vision beyond that. They came to you in great numbers in this place. Perhaps the spirit of bison is telling the Zelandanyi that there has been too much hunting of bison, and we need to suspend the hunting of them for the rest of the year to atone, to overcome the bad luck. There were murmurs of assent. It made the Zelandanya feel better to think they could do something to placate the bison spirit and remove the ill fortune the unexpected death presaged. They would inform their caves of the ban on bison hunting, almost grateful to have a message to bring them. The acolytes gathered up the things that were brought into the cave. Then the lamps were all relit and used to light their way out. The Zelandanya left the chamber and retraced their steps. When they reached the ledge outside the cave, the sun was setting in a brilliant display of fiery reds, golds, and yellows in the west. On the way back from Fountain Rocks, no one seemed inclined to talk much about their experiences in the deep cave. As the various Zelandanya left the group to return to their respective caves, Ayla wondered what the others had felt and if it was the same thing that she had, but she was reluctant to bring it up. Though she had many questions, she wasn't sure if it was appropriate to ask or if she really wanted to know the answers. Zelandani asked Jondalar if he was satisfied that they had found his brother's spirit and helped his Elan to find his way. Jondalar said he thought Thonolin was content, and therefore he was, but Ayla thought it was more that he was relieved. He had done what he could, though it hadn't been easy for him. Now the burden of worrying about it was over. By the time Ayla, Jondalar, Zelandani, and Jonakal reached the ninth cave, only the lonely flickering lights in the night sky and the small fires in their stone lamps and torches remained to light their way. Ayla and Jondalar were both tired when they reached Marthona's dwelling. Wolf was nervously excited and very happy to see Ayla. After comforting the animal and exchanging greetings, they had a light meal, and not long after went to bed. It had been a difficult few days.
"Can I help you cook this morning, Marthona?" Ayla asked.
They were the first to awake and were enjoying a quiet cup of tea together while everyone else still slept.
"I'd like to learn how you like food prepared and where you keep things."
"I'd be happy to have your help, Ayla, but this morning we've all been invited to share a morning meal with Joharan and Proliva. Zelandani has been invited, too. Proliva often cooks for her, and I think Joharan feels that he hasn't had much time to talk with his brother since he returned. He seems particularly interested in learning more about that new spear-throwing weapon," Marthona said. Jondalar woke up remembering the discussion about abalones and how important it was to Ayla to feel that she belonged. Since she had no memory of her own people and no longer had any connection with the people who had raised her, it was understandable. She had even left behind the Mamutoi, who had made her one of them, to go home with him. The thought preyed on his mind all through the meal with Joharan's family. Everyone there belonged to the Zelandanyi. They were all his family, his cave, his people. Only Ayla was not. It was true they would soon be mated, but she would still be Ayla of the Mamutoi, mated to Jondalar of the Zelandanyi. After a discussion with Joharan about the spear-thrower, exchanging anecdotes with Willemar about traveling, and general conversation with everyone about the summer meeting, the talk turned to Jondalar and Ayla's mating at the first matrimonial. Marthona was explaining to Ayla that there were two mating ceremonies each summer. The first, and usually the biggest one, was held as early as reasonably possible. Most people who would be joined then had been making the arrangements for some time. The second one was conducted shortly before they left, and usually mated those who decided to tie the knot during the summer. There were also two womanhood ceremonies, one shortly after they arrived, and the second just before the summer meeting ended. Impulsively, Jondalar interrupted her explanations. "I would like Ayla to belong, to become one of us. After we are mated, I would like her to be Ayla of the ninth cave of the Zelandanyi, not Ayla of the Mamutoi.
I know that is usually a decision that a person's mother or the man of her hearth makes when that person wants to change affiliation along with the leaders and Zelindania. But Mahmut gave the choice to Ayla when she left. If she is willing, can I have your agreement, mother?
Marthona was startled by the suddenness of his request and was caught off guard.
I would not refuse you, Jandalar, she said, feeling that her son had put her in an untenable position to ask such a thing in public without warning. But it is not entirely up to me. I am happy to welcome Ayla to the ninth cave of the Zelindani, but it is your brother and Zelindani and others, including Ayla herself, who have a say in that decision.
Falara grinned, knowing that her mother did not like to be taken by surprise like that. It rather pleased her that Jandalar had caught her without warning, but she had to admit, Marthona had recovered well.
"Well, I, for one, would not hesitate to accept her," Willemar said. "I would even adopt her, but since I am mated to your mother, Jandalar, I am afraid it would make her a sister, like Falara, an unmateable woman. I don't think you would want that."
"No, but I appreciate the thought," Jandalar said.
"Why do you bring it up now?" Marthona asked, still a little miffed.
"It seemed as good a time as any," Jandalar said. "We'll be leaving soon for the summer meeting, and I would like it settled before we go. I know we haven't been home very long, but most of you have gotten to know Ayla. I think she would be a valuable addition to the ninth cave."
Ayla was more than a little surprised, too, but she said nothing.
"Do I want to be adopted by the Zelindani?" she asked herself. "Does it matter? If Jandalar and I are going to be mated, I will be the same as one, whether I have the name or not. He seems to want it. I'm not sure why, but maybe he has a good reason. He knows his people much better than I do."
"Perhaps I should tell you something, Jandalar," Joharan said. "I think to those of us who know her, Ayla would be a more than acceptable addition to our cave. But not everyone feels that way. When I was walking back from downriver, I decided to tell Larimar and some others about the bison feast, and when I approached, I overheard them talking. I'm sorry to say they were making disparaging remarks, in particular about her healing skills and treatment of Chevenar. They seem to feel that anyone who learned healing from the clan could not know much. It's their prejudice talking, I'm afraid. I told them no one, not even Zelindani, could have done more, and I must admit they made me angry. That's not always the best time to make a point."
So that's why he was so angry, Ayla thought. The knowledge gave her mixed feelings. She was upset by what those men said about Issa's healing abilities, but pleased that Joharan had spoken up for her.
"All the more reason to make her one of us now," Jandalar said. "You know those men. They do nothing but gamble and drink Larimar's barma. They haven't even bothered to learn a craft or a skill, unless you consider gambling one. They're not even decent hunters. They're lazy, worthless men who contribute nothing unless they're shamed into it, and they have little shame. They'll do anything to avoid making an effort toward helping the cave, and everyone knows it. No one will pay attention to what they say if the ones people respect are willing to accept her and make her Zelindani."
He was obviously upset. He wanted Ayla to be accepted for herself, and this put a different character on it.
"That's not entirely true about Larimar, Jandalar," Proliva said. "He may be lazy about most things, and I don't think he likes to hunt much, but Larimar does have a skill. He can make a drinkable beverage out of almost anything that will ferment. I've known him to use grains, fruits, honey, birch sap, even some roots, and turn out a drink that most people like, and he makes it for almost every occasion when people get together. It's true some people overdo